Now to Washington, where there's been an outcry over a video shared on Donald Trump's social media feed depicting Barack Obama and Michelle Obama as monkeys. That blatantly racist imagery has now been deleted following criticism, not just from Democrats, but Republicans as well. The party's only black senator, Tim Scott, said it's the most racist thing I've seen out of this White House. There's always so much to talk about, and this week we wanted to slow things down and take stock to separate the signal from the noise, as our next guest often puts it. She's Caddy Kay. She's the host of the hugely popular podcast, The Rest is Politics US. She's also the BBC's US special correspondent. Caddy Kay, welcome back to Saturday Extra.
Well, Nick, it's so good to talk to you from Washington, where I'm stuck under 2 foot of snow and freezing weather, and you seem to be in a T-shirt, so something's very unfair about this.
And you wonder why I left America for Australia.
Just in time.
That's it in a nutshell. Let's deal with this racist video first of all. We've been covering Donald Trump together since he first came down that golden escalator in June 2015. More than 10 years on, Caddy, he hasn't lost the capacity to shock. I mean, what have you made of this latest controversy and the opposition, not just from Democrats, but senior Republicans as well?
Well, I guess if we're going to talk about, you know, in the context of signal and noise, the signal here is that you had Republicans speaking up. And is that a kind of sign of the times that Donald Trump is losing some of his pull over the power, some of his powers of persuasion when it comes to the Republican Party? Because this is not the first time. Yes, it's an incredibly shocking image. Are we totally surprised? No. Donald Trump sent out something like, you know, half a dozen Truth Social posts in the space of a very short time in the middle of the night, as he's wont to do. Did he even watch the video till the end? Who knows? But it's rare for him to row back like this. It's rare for the Republicans, particularly Tim Scott, you mentioned him, who's been a staunch ally of Donald Trump's, was even tipped as vice presidential material at one point. And for him to speak out, and not just for them to ask for this to be taken down, but for them to ask for Donald Trump to apologize. Remember, Donald Trump's motto is, you know, you always claim that you've won, you deny everything, and you certainly never apologize. But for now, I think by my count, 3 or 4 fairly senior Republicans to come out and say he has to apologize, that is a shift. And why are they doing it? Are they doing it just because this was a very shocking incident, even by the standards of Donald Trump? Or are they doing it because they now feel a little bit more emboldened to criticize Donald Trump in public on X, given the president's poll ratings? I think some of that plays into this as well. But it's an interesting moment. And, the president's had a pretty bad run the last month in terms of having to back down on things. By my count, this is number 4 of the big backdowns. So I think that's interesting to see as well.
Yeah, I'm fascinated by that. Initially, the White House did defend this post. President Trump's spokeswoman, Caroline Levitt, called it faux outrage. She said the internet meme was a video depicting President Trump as the king of the jungle and the Democrats as characters from The Lion King. But obviously, this was an ugly, a grotesque racist trope. And later, we did see that climb down from the White House. As you say, it tells us something about the present political climate. Climb downs from Donald Trump are rare, but we've seen a few recently over Greenland, over his comments about NATO troops not fighting on the front lines in Afghanistan. There was something of a retreat from Minneapolis. They do seem more sensitive to criticism, Caddy, and there does seem to be more criticism.
Well, I mean, either the president's kind of losing his touch, and, you know, the gossip in Washington, where I'm speaking to you from, is full of, is the president more frail than he was? How is his health? Is he stumbling more? Is he falling asleep in meetings? That could be some wishful thinking from Democrats who would like to see this president put, you know, being less powerful than he has been. But the president's numbers are pretty terrible. And I think there are ways in which he is out of step in a way that is weird for Donald Trump, right? I mean, Nick, you've covered him for longer than I have. I know that you met him in New York years before I was even really aware of him. And he's had this sort of magic capacity to be in touch with sort of public opinion, particularly with kind of anti-woke public opinion. But on all of those things you just mentioned, he's out of touch with public opinion. There was no public support. There was no. I spoke to very senior Republicans. I texted on the weekend of the kind of Davos conference with a very senior Republican senator who is very close to the White House, who told me there is zero Republican support for military action against Greenland. There was zero public support for action against Greenland. There was a lot of horror amongst veterans when he said that NATO forces from around the world hadn't served in the front lines in places like Afghanistan. He's out of touch when it comes to Minneapolis. There's a new Quinnipiac poll showing that 51% of Americans now think that the president's immigration policies make them feel less safe, not more safe, less safe. So I think there are missteps being made by the White House, which are perhaps sometimes uncharacteristic of Donald Trump, who has his kind of finger on the pulse of the Republican Party. And I think as he starts looking at the midterm elections and sees the direction that the country is going, the direction that public opinion is going, that's kind of pushing these slightly more dramatic but also unpopular positions that he's taking. And I wouldn't be surprised if we saw more of that over the course of the next year as he tries to find his footing and get back kind of in the groove of where he thinks MAGA voters are.
A big question we've asked over the past year is, where is the resistance to Donald Trump? I think the question now really is, where is the support for Donald Trump? Historically speaking, after a year in office, he has got historically low approval ratings. The only other president who had approval ratings like this was the 45th president. And the 45th president, of course, was Donald Trump. You've gone to the midterms. I mean, they're hanging on in the House. They're in a slightly better position in the US Senate, where the Republicans have a majority at the moment. I mean, is there this confidence now in the Democrats that a blue wave, blue is the colour of the Democrats, obviously, that a blue wave is going to sweep across the country?
I had a conversation with Chris Coons, who's the senator from Delaware, Democratic senator from Delaware, and he's didn't describe it to me as a blue wave. He does think that the Democrats will win the House, but he thinks they're looking at something like a 5-seat margin, which is all they would need to do to be able to put the kind of gum up some of the president's initiatives and launch a whole load of investigations. So I think the Democrats are feeling more confident. I mean, one thing that's worth looking at, I think, Nick, is, and I get asked this question the whole time, especially when I travel to Europe, where are the Democrats? Why are they so hopeless? Why haven't they got their act together? Actually, if you look around the country over the course of last year, there was something like 50 races, elections, 50 elections for statewide Senate or House seats. And remember, every state in America has a Senate and has a House of Representatives. And in those 50 elections, there was something like a 13-point swing from Republicans to Democrats on average. That's a heck of a swing. I mean, that suggests to me that actually around the country, kind of below the radar, because Donald Trump sucks up all of the attention and gets all of the headlines, which is exactly how he wants it. Actually, kind of if you look below the headlines, Democrats all during last year were making gains because voters in the country didn't necessarily like what they were seeing coming out of the White House, particularly around the question of economics and affordability. So, yes, I think Democrats are finding more of their confidence speaking up publicly, but I think actually American voters have been telling us, not that we necessarily have noticed it that much, but they have been telling us that they are not happy with this White House.
You're listening to ABC Radio National. I'm Nick Bryant on Saturday Extra, and I'm talking with Cathy Kay, the host of the popular podcast The Rest is Politics US. And I'm also going to bring in another host of a popular podcast, the news agents. John Sopel is with us as well. John, hi. Good morning to you.
Morning, Nick. Morning, Cathy.
This feels like a BBC
Washington
reunion.
This is like
reunion.
A kind of real Georgetown reunion.
It is a Georgetown reunion. You were actually neighbours, weren't you, in Georgetown? You lived on the same street, and weirdly, in the 1990s, to give this even more of an incestuous feel, I lived on that street as well. John, we were talking there about the sort of dwindling popularity of Donald Trump. I mean, I was posing the question to Caddy. You know, we often talk about where's the resistance, but at the moment, you're kind of wondering where the support is. I mean, he is sort of in the doldrums right now. And as we were talking with Cathy, you know, we have seen these climb downs from Donald Trump over Greenland, over the NATO troops, over Minneapolis to an extent. You know, I wonder what you make of what's happening.
Well, I think, you know, I was listening intently to what you and Cathy were just talking about. And I kind of thought at the end of Thatcher, when she was Prime Minister of Britain, and she introduces a poll tax, and that there had been this woman who had led the country for years, who everyone thought was infallible, and that what she would always do would be the most popular thing, and then comes up with a policy that is so ruinous and so hated that it speeds her out of Downing Street. And I'm not saying we're at that point now, but I do think there is, you know, I always thought that kind of, you know, when we all reported on, you know, Trump Clinton in 2016, that you felt that every piece of messaging from Hillary Clinton had been sieved, had been poll tested. And with Trump, you just thought, my God, his gut is unbelievable for kind of sensing where the heart of American opinion is. And maybe, you know, as the time has gone on in the White House, and, you know, you've seen the monetization of the presidency as well, that is he really that in touch with ordinary Americans in the way that he could once boast quite fairly that he was? Or has he lost some of that and now just looks like another creature of the establishment?
Yeah, that's fascinating. Katie, you were in Texas this week, and Texas last Saturday saw this shock result, really, didn't it? It was a special election for a state Senate seat. And in a Trump stronghold, the Republican candidate actually ended up losing. I mean, what were you hearing on the ground in Texas? What does that tell us about the situation nationally?
So it's an interesting, you know, you always have to be a little bit careful about these special elections. Sure. And these state Senate elections. And we've seen instances where Democrats have done very well in special elections and then not done very well later. I don't know that I would describe that district, which is in Fort Worth, Texas, where there was a 31-point swing away from Donald Trump to a Democrat, as necessarily a Trump stronghold. I mean, it's a mixed suburban area. It has some Hispanic areas and it has kind of white middle-class suburban areas. I think the most interesting thing that's happening across, if you kind of look at all of these elections and you kind of drill down into what strategists here love to call the crosstabs of election polling, is that the two groups that Donald Trump has lost support among are young voters and Hispanic voters. And that was the case in the election that Taylor Remmert, the Democrat, just won in Texas. He did well. He did much better amongst Hispanic voters than Democrats, than Kamala Harris had done last in November of the 2024 election. And I think that gets us to this ICE issue, that there are a lot of Hispanic voters who actually support the idea of shutting the border. But Donald Trump has now shut the border, and he's given ICE quotas for people to deport. But unlike Barack Obama and unlike Joe Biden, he can't just go to the border and round people up who have just crossed over and send them back again, and those be his deportation numbers, because no one's coming across the border. So that's why he's having to go into these communities. And Hispanic voters are seeing other Hispanics being pulled off the street, some of them American citizens, some of them not American citizens, and sent into deportation camps, including a five-year-old boy. And the image of the five-year-old boy went completely viral all over America, who was sent into a deportation camp. And guess what? They don't love it, because it makes them think, I could be next. I could be picked up just because I speak Spanish in the street, just because I am Hispanic, I could be picked up as well. And I think that erosion of the two groups that slightly improbably pushed Donald Trump over the edge in 2024, because they were the people that were unhappy with prices and unhappy with the open border, actually that's going to be a real problem, not just for Donald Trump, but for Republican members of Congress in the midterm elections, Republicans who have already said in Colorado, in Florida, who have large Hispanic populations, like that state Senate seat in Texas, which looks a lot like a lot of those Republican seats. They are the ones that are worried about this. They are the ones that are pushing for a change in immigration policy, because they see that it could really hurt them come the midterm elections. And that's why they're watching Texas.
John, it seems to me two big things have happened this year. On the domestic front, we have had Minneapolis, the killings of Renee Good, the killing of Alex Pretty, caught on camera, an iconic image which kind of reminds us of some of the images from the 1960s, which changed the nation's thinking about the struggle for black equality. And you've also had Davos and that speech from Mark Carney, the Canadian Prime Minister, which seems to have had a sort of spine-stiffening effect on international leaders. You've had pushback from Donald Trump at home. You've had pushback from Donald Trump abroad in the opening weeks of this year. Do you see this as a kind of turning point in Trump 2.0?
I think it's too soon to say that. I think if you look at the disposition of the European Union, you look at the disposition of the United Kingdom, their temptation still is to find accommodation, that somehow if you play nicely with Donald Trump, then you'll get something in return. If you're confrontational with him, ooh, do you have the courage to go there, given what might come back at you? And I think that, yeah, there is some people who are, I mean, Mark Carney's speech was remarkable because it was from a neighbor of the United States who was saying the New World Order or the Old World Order was gone and we've just got to face up to the fact of it. But I don't think there have been many other Mark Carney speeches and people rallying. I mean, I think the Greenland thing was kind of discreet and separate. But as Trump, you know, threatens new tariffs and whatever else, people start to worry and are fearful. I mean, the people that have really stood up to him are the Chinese, where they suddenly said, OK, you want to impose these tariffs, we're going to slap, you know, we're going to stop the export of rare earth minerals. And immediately Trump capitulated. You know, Trump responds to strength. And he did a bit over Greenland, where he realized that he didn't have anyone with him. But I still think that Trump, you know, wherever it is, he's still going to try and bully his way to what he wants to happen. And, you know, it was remarkable what happened in Venezuela and how little pushback there was. And, you know, he's got the Iranians for the negotiating table. We'll see what, if anything, comes out of that. I mean, there's a lot of bluster. And I think there's a lot of kind of fury in Europe and a lot of willing Donald Trump to fail and that he will have to change course. But I don't think they want to be the first one to poke the bear.
Caddy, just a final thought with you, and I'm going to keep talking to John, actually, because we want to talk about how the Epstein scandal has reverberated in Britain. But just a quick thought on how it's reverberated in Washington. Donald Trump was mentioned more than 6,000 times in these millions of documents, but no smoking gun. He wants to move on. Obviously, these documents have been heavily redacted by the Justice Department before their release. Has his Epstein problem gone away?
Well, the joke on Saturday Night Live last weekend was that they released the Epstein files to distract from ICE activities in Minneapolis, that ICE was so bad. I think there are still going to be rumblings about Epstein here. It's interesting that you've seen nothing like what we had in the UK. But I think the kind of problem that it creates for Republicans and that it creates for the White House, but more broadly for Republicans, is that the Epstein files reinforce this idea that there is a two-tier system of justice, that you have the rich and powerful for whom a certain set of rules apply, and they can get away with things, and they can make an awful lot of money, and you can have a K-shaped economic recovery, and their assets will do super well, and the stock market is booming. And then you have the rest of the country, particularly in this case, the victims of Epstein. And it was compounded by the fact that the DOJ could not even be bothered to make sure that they redacted the names and the faces of these young girls who had been sexually abused by Jeffrey Epstein. And now they're kind of trying to row back on that. But it made it look like they just didn't care that much about the victims of Epstein. And I think that is going to be a problem for the Republican Party, because there is a feeling in America, an economic feeling, and this Epstein feel kind of files issue compounds it, that the rich and powerful get away with things. And average people don't get away with things. So average people are suffering from high gas prices, from high rents, from high inflation and grocery prices, and other people are doing very well. The victims are suffering from Jeffrey Epstein, but the perpetrators haven't been brought to justice. And I do think actually that in the long run, that is more of a problem for the Republican Party and potentially for the White House than it might seem to be at the moment, where it looks like Donald Trump has just got away with this.
Caddy, it's approaching the cocktail hour in Washington, so we're going to let you go. John, it's still the flat white hour here in Sydney. Caddy,
you guys have to work.
Before Caddy goes, I thought the better joke was that they released the Epstein files to detract from the Melania movie.
That's what I was going to say too.
That's made a lot of money.
That was a good look. I think we've got the makings of a new podcast here. The rest is the news agents. How about it? The coming together of two great pods. Caddy, always great to talk to you. John, we'll keep this conversation going in a moment. You are listening to ABC Radio National Saturday Extra with me, Nick Bryant.
3 million pages, 180,000 images, and 2,000 videos.
The latest release of the Epstein files has triggered its first police investigation. A criminal probe has been launched into Peter Mandelson, the former British government minister and ambassador to the United States.
Donald Trump's name appears thousands of times in these new documents. Howard Lutnick tried to meet or call with Epstein several times. Elon Musk asked Jeffrey Epstein, when should we head to your island?
Norway's crown princess has been named in the latest round of Jeffrey Epstein files. The princess appears to have shared a series of flirty exchanges with Epstein between 2011 and 2014.
Sarah Ferguson wrote to Epstein in 2009 after he was convicted of procuring a minor for prostitution. Just marry me, she wrote.
Among the Epstein files are more than 1,000 documents that name Vladimir Putin and more than 9,000 that refer to Moscow.
He is a textbook example of an access agent.
The UK Prime Minister has come under extreme pressure about what he knew about Lord Mandelson's connections to Jeffrey Epstein when he appointed him as US ambassador.
Well, it really is a scandal that has ricocheted around the world. And mentioned in the release files was a who's who of the rich and influential, although being mentioned is not necessarily an indication of wrongdoing. Bill Clinton, Bill Gates, the right-wing provocateur Steve Bannon, the left-wing intellectual Noam Chomsky, Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, as he's now called, Vladimir Putin. And of course, the people we should never forget are those who often go unnamed, the victims of Jeffrey Epstein. Well, the thinking was the Epstein files might threaten the future of a US president, Donald Trump, but they've actually imperiled the UK Prime Minister, Keir Starmer. John Sopel from the News Agents podcast is still with us. John, the British end of this scandal centres on a guy called Peter Mandelson, a man who needs no introduction in Britain. Lots of people, obviously, here in Australia have heard of him too. But just give us a quick pen portrait of someone really who's been a human headline since, what, the early 1990s?
Yeah, he has been the eminence grise of the Labour Party. When kind of Labour lost to Margaret Thatcher in three consecutive elections and then lost to John Major, Peter Mandelson was the behind-the-scenes genius who rebranded Labour, took it more towards the centre, appealed to middle-class voters, and hey presto, Tony Blair wins a landslide. He becomes a minister, is forced to resign over his contacts with a very wealthy Labour MP who he took a home loan from for, you know, $750,000 Australian dollars and didn't declare it. He then had to resign again. He was brought back in, resigned again over contacts with a very wealthy Indian billionaire this time. And so with Peter Mandelson, there has always been the whiff of cordite, the sense of danger, a great belief, you know, of jeopardy. But then Keir Starmer goes and appoints him to be our ambassador in Washington, the most plum appointment that there is. At the time, people were more worried about Peter Mandelson's other business connections. They didn't raise the Epstein stuff, even though that was known. But now, given the extent of the contacts that he had with Epstein and almost seemed to be handing over to him, according to the, you know, the release of the files, confidential documents that were floating within government that were market sensitive about asset sales that Epstein's clients could have benefited from. People are saying, hang on, was Peter Mandelson, then the Deputy Prime Minister in Britain, working for the British or working for Jeffrey Epstein? And that calls into question, why didn't Keir Starmer look harder into what Peter Mandelson's suitability was to be our ambassador?
A criminal probe is underway, isn't it? Two properties linked to Peter Mandelson have been searched by British police. We've woken up to that news in Australia today. Yeah. How much of a threat does this pose to Keir Starmer? As you say, it raises questions about the judgment around appointing him to Washington in the first place.
Oh, I think this is deadly, deadly serious for Keir Starmer. So what Starmer has said is that he will make public the vetting documents that were gathered, the material gathered before his appointment. If Keir Starmer has been in, I mean, and the way Starmer has tried to paint this is that Mandelson lied and lied and lied. If it shows that the right questions weren't asked or scant attention was paid to what Mandelson was saying about his relationship with Epstein, and, you know, Keir Starmer wanted to appoint a big figure to become our ambassador, that was Mandelson, someone who had, you know, knowledge of trade negotiations. He was formerly a European Union commissioner for trade. That was Mandelson, and just didn't take much notice of what was in the files. Then I think Keir Starmer is toast. I think that he could be gone within weeks if it is shown that they knew stuff and just didn't ask enough questions. And if they've been in any way disingenuous in what they knew, again, I think it's really serious. And the fact of the matter is that although Keir Starmer's only been Prime Minister for, 18 months, he has squandered so much authority by bad decisions that he's then had to U-turn on. He wasn't going to disclose all this information. He's had to U-turn on that. And people are just saying, enough. And this, I think, is the straw that is breaking the camel's back in terms of, you know, the respect, not just of the British public. The British public have got very low opinion of Keir Starmer, but of his own members of parliament who are just saying, enough, this cannot go on.
John, I know you've got grandfatherly duties to perform. Just a 30-second answer to this question. The British Labour Party does not have the camelistic fury of the Australian Labour Party. They do not generally oust prime ministers in the same way the British Conservative Party does. But you really think this is an occasion where that might happen?
I think it is. And I think that, you know, look, I think that governing has become more difficult in all countries. And I think that what's happening in Britain is that they're looking at the polls, the Labour MPs. And I think that, you know, the Labour Party has always been, in the UK, the Labour Party has always been this nostalgic kind of party that always revered the people who lost because they stuck to their principles and they wouldn't give in. You know, politics is about winning. You can't do much if you're in opposition. And what's happening now is that the Labour Party is thinking, okay, this isn't working for us. He's got to go. And Keir Starmer, who is fundamentally a decent man, I think, you know, is skating on incredibly thin ice right now.
John Sopel, former North America editor of the BBC, now the host of the popular podcast, The News Agents. Thanks so much, John, for joining us on Saturday
Lovely
Extra.
Lovely to speak to you, Nick.
Great
Cheers.
To see you. Take care.
Think bigger about the world we live in. Ask your smart speaker to play ABC RN.